Our next speaker is Susan Holmes. It's a great pleasure to have her today. She's a professor at Stanford. She's very interested in developing new computational and statistical approaches to unravel complex biological data sets. And today she's going to tell us about challenges posed by the analysis of the human microbiome. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Only invite me to Boston in October. That's all I have to say. I lived here for 3 years. Okay, so I got really interested in microbiome about more than 10 years ago. And the challenge here is multi-domain data, and that's really what I'm interested in. That is, heterogeneous data are the challenge of everything that we're doing today in biology. That is, we're trying to combine not just one source of data. People talk about big data. I'm not interested in that. I think that the multi-domain is the challenge. And the data I'm going to talk to you about today comes from several projects that I'm involved in. I have a large grant with David Relman to study resilience and perturbations in the human microbiome. And I also work on the March of Dimes study of preterm pregnancy. And so we're trying to look at perturbations on our longitudinal data. And I'll explain a little bit some of the challenges. A lot of them have to do with the quality of the different types of data that come in, the different types of noise, the graph and tree integration, and elements that usually you couldn't just put in a Euclidean distance in a standard way. And then I'm very wedded to reproducibility, so all of my code and all of the data I'm going to talk about that's been published is already publicly available. So what are the data? So happily, we already had a talk at lunchtime about the human microbiome and the biota. And so I want to talk. I agree completely that it's the place where medicine meets ecology. I think that's an interesting explanation. And the different types of data that we have come at different levels. So there's one gene, which is called the 16S RNA gene, which serves as a signature fingerprint for all the different species of bacteria. And so that's one which we concentrate a lot on. There's also the fact that you can just shotgun and sequence everything that's there and look at all the genes, and that's called the metagenome. And you can do what we do on other types of data, RNA-seq, to see what's expressed by all these different genes. And we do a lot of mass spec as well to look at the proteomics. And then there's a lot of clinical variables and environmental variables which are really important, like diet and, you know, time, seasonal effects, and things like that. We have a lot of domain knowledge that you can't just ignore. So some people feel as if in order to be objective, you have to be dumb. And so you have to pretend that you only know one thing at a time. And that is just a big mistake. So you're throwing out a lot of information, and you want to take into account everything you know in the way you analyze the data. And that's one of the things that we've really tried to do, that is integrate networks or phylogenetics trees into the way that we compare things. And I like that here there hasn't been a single talk where people have talked about metadata. They talk about phenotypes, and I'm with you. That is, there's a whole field of bioinformatics who let the NSA carry on with their metadata, and this isn't really data. Everything you collect is data, and you have to integrate it. So we have to find out how to combine the data of different types. Now, we've written a computational system around R and Bioconductor, which makes heterogeneous data objects where you don't lose any of the links between the clinical variables, the phylogenetic tree, the taxa, the samples across time. And that's been very important. From a more mathematical point of view, and since you know we're trying to look at the computations, I think it's useful to think about many of these data sets, although it's not economical for graphs, for instance, but think about them as matrices. So you have many matrices. You might have time series, the same subjects over time, so you can consider them as matrices of counts. You might have posterior distributions. There are many matrices over time. Networks in longitudinal studies, they're still matrices. It's a good way of thinking about them mathematically. And this data is always finite, so we don't have to do too much, you know, infinite matrices. Now, I was brought up in a French dogma, and so I'm going to make you support it for a few minutes. I don't think like a probabilistic math statistician. I'm a data analyst, and I think about everything geometrically. So for me, we have two dual spaces. You have the space of the variables, say abundances of taxa, and all the samples lie in that space. And then you have the other side of things where you can look at the variables as measured for each of the different samples. Now, that duality is actually useful. We create inner products on both spaces, and you just decide which space you care about, and often it's by cheating on the dimension. That is, you look at the dimension, which is very large, and you're going to not, you know, that's not the dimensionality of your problem. If you only have 50 samples, the dimensionality can't be bigger than 50. So people say, oh, you know, we have 40,000 variables. Yeah, but it still sits in 50 dimensions. So you don't have to worry about having so many things you're measuring. It just depends on, you know, what side of what projection you make. But if you use any kind of spectral method or kernel methods, that actually matters. It brings down the dimensionality. So I have we have a geometrical approach to that. And we can put metrics on. And this really matters when you do data integration. You have to care about how much information, how much weighting you're putting on all the different variables, because they're going to have a different effect. And if you feel as if, you know, in one domain you have much more information than in another domain, you want to take that into account. This is a little bit similar to if you have high variance, high variability, on one variable, you may not want to make exactly all the variances be one. So the rescaling of the tables and rescaling of the variables, they're a little bit similar. It's just, you know, in spades in some way. So the standard methods, and many people who've talked here have already talked about PCA and dimension reduction. They're all based on, you take an inner product, you take the eigen decomposition of, you know, the cross product matrix, and then you take a couple of eigen functions and you project the data down. Now, you might do that in different ways, but basically that's a simple framework. And so I call that generalized PCA, but, you know, this is very standard and very easy to do on the computer. And what we're going to try and do is just change a little bit the metrics that we put in, the S and the V that are here. And we're going to change them so that we integrate more information about the relationships between the variables that we get. So this is the duality diagram we call, and this is why you can go back and forth, as I was saying before, between which of the operators you diagonalize. And just to say that you can frame many of the standard statistical methods in the same way. So one of the interesting ones, and one which we'll extrapolate in some sense, is discriminant analysis. So discriminant analysis isn't the same as PCA, just in the fact that you don't look for the directions, the eigenvectors that maximize the simple variance. You want to maximize the variance between the groups, and you're given a group variability. And usually you're given labels for the groups, and you just want to try and spread out those labels. So you can actually write down discriminant analysis, and that's useful in some way as a decomposition with this same commutative diagram. It's just you have a different metric, and you have a metric, for instance, that takes into account, here we have the total variation, and then you have the within-class variation, which also occurs, and then we're going to just diagonalize a different matrix, and we have a different weighting scheme. You can think of discriminant analysis as a special case of PCA. I want to do something a little bit different. I want to not completely take perfect groups into account. I have groups that appear along a tree, so I'm going to do something a little bit more sophisticated.
Analysis, or the other way around?
No, it's the other way around.
So
discriminant analysis is a special case of generalized PCA. Discriminant analysis is eigendecomposition, and you can put in the weights here, this triplet here, so that this is a PCA, but it gives you the discriminant variables. And if you could think about it this way, think that you're giving special weights and you take the mean points of each of the groups and you do PCA with regards to that and you have a special weighting. And that's the same thing. But it's useful when you want to go to sort of intermediary. So as I said, we're going to look at many matrices over time. And here I've put in here some of the information that we'd like to take into account. So for the taxa, the different species, we know phylogenetic trees. These are given to us. For genetic networks, we have genetic interactions. We have protein-protein interactions or genetic reactions that we can induce and we already know. And when you're doing functional data, for instance, if you have mass spec and metabolite data, you know the metabolic network. So we actually want to use metrics which take all of those into account. The earliest way of doing this was to say everything is distances, and if we can make the right distance, then we can make low-dimensional representation of these distances. And this actually came from the work of Schoenberg. And the idea there is to say, you're given a matrix, it's symmetric, positive numbers, we're going to find the points in Euclidean space which have distances which are as close as possible to those given distances. And so that method is called multidimensional scaling. In one world, it's called PCOA in the world of ecology. And that's been the workhorse of most of the early work on microbial ecology is based on this PCOA. Now, the secret sauce here is the distance. That is, you have to choose a distance which is relevant for your data. So people use Bray-Curtis distance. There are actually 40 different distances from which to choose from. So it's quite troubling because in some sense, you already have to know what you're looking for. There's some metric learning sort of inference in there when you are choosing your distance. But there is a way to take into account the distance on the tree between the species and then doing a PCOA on those points. So the way that works, and this is called double principal coordinate analysis, and that was first developed by ecologists, and my PhD student, Elizabeth Purdom, developed it for the microbiome. And that's that you're given the samples are at different locations, say, and those locations, you have measurements of abundances of all the taxa, and you have a relationship between, a tree relationship between the taxa. So you start by taking the distance on the tree between the species, you build a coordinate space, Euclidean, and then you take the points, the abundances, as the weights on the coordinate spaces. And so that's a little bit abstract. Let me show you on an example, but that's the idea. It's called double principal coordinate analysis. So this is what it looks like on antibiotic time course data. So in this first preliminary study that David Relman did, there were three subjects, and there were about 2,500 different taxa that were measured on 50 time points on these three subjects. And we're trying to understand the time points corresponded. There were two courses of antibiotics. I'm trying to understand the resilience. That is, some of the subjects change under antibiotic stress, the abundances of the bacteria. And so the way that I just said, we take the phylogeny or the relationship between the different taxa, which is known, and you can make a multidimensional scaling, a PCOA of those points, and then take each of these points and their abundances and take those as the weights, and then you get a representation of all the samples. So the first thing you see here is the green, the red, and the blue, the colors are all the different subjects. And the first thing about the microbiome is the only thing that matters if you're trying to differentiate is the person. Every person has their own ecology. There are lots of degrees of freedom, and we're all very different. So that is the main motivation why all the studies I'm going to show you are longitudinal. That is, you can only really use the person as their own control when you're doing a perturbation study. And this is the relationship that we see. Now, what I want to show you really is what happens with the perturbation. So under stress, I'm going to make some of those samples be of one type. Those will be the stress, that is, when they're taking antibiotics and just after. And the other will be what happened before and a long time after the antibiotics. So the E1 is under stress, and E2 is when they're back to normal. So what you see is within each subject, so the subject-to-subject differences, but there is a tendency for these two subjects to have the same direction. They shifted in the same way. So the stress seems to be the same. Here, we had a particular type of subject who didn't react, so wasn't resilient in the same way. And so these representations enabled us to see, well, there's something to be studied about, you know, what they do together, what is common to the subjects, and some of the subjects, one group of subjects, sort of don't seem to show much difference. So we did a larger study, and I'm going to show you that now. And this study just appeared in August in PLOS Computational Biology. And here what we wanted to do was adapt the DPCOA to be less severe. That is, in some sense, we don't believe that the only component of variance, the only thing that's moving the variability, is the phylogenetic tree. We believe that, you know, evolution and the tree between the different taxa is important, but we believe there's a whole part of the variability which isn't linked to the tree. So we wanted to modulate the tree. And so this is this is a sparkline plot. In fact, every line that's coming out of this is a time series, and I'll give you a better plot of it. But this is the phylogenetic tree of the different taxa that are found. So first of all, this is a small part of a larger study. Here we only have 8 patients. We actually have 100 subjects that we recruited through the quantified self. So wonderful method for recruiting subjects, the quantified self. Big problem, not a good demographic sample. The quantified self, it's young men between the age of 25 and 35. We had more than 100 people of these type sign up within the first week, and then we had to say, No, we don't want any more of you. We want more, because usually recruitment is a big problem. So we were very excited to begin with. We get all these people recruiting, then we look at the profiles, and they're completely homogeneous. So this is a subset of them. And these are colonic cleanouts that the subject volunteered to do. And they were... As you see, the time points are not equally distributed. That is, we have very heavy density in sampling around the perturbation. So that's a carefully designed statistical study in some sense. That is, in statistics, when you make an experimental design, you always collect more points where you have high variance, so high perturbation. And then outside, we have more regularly sampled points. And this is not antibiotics. We have several runs of perturbations for the same subjects. This is just the colonic cleanout. So here, we actually mathematically constructed a prior which was in between the tree and just having an ordinary variance covariance matrix. And the way we did it is by constructing a kernel. And in order to make a kernel which sort of obeys a tree, we took Brownian motion. And the correlation is, if the correlation is very high, we suppose that along the Brownian motion, the particles are staying the same along the same path. And then when they're splitting off, then they become independent. You know, they're losing their dependency. So the length of the branches high up in the tree tells you how correlated the variables are. So this is quite a realistic model for a phylogenetic tree, but it enables us to build, in some sense, this kernel. And I won't belabor the... Yes? So the nodes here are going to be the taxa. Yeah. And so we're going to build a metric such that the covariance, in some sense, is, you know, if the taxa are right down at the bottom of the tree together, they're going to be very correlated. Yeah, so, but that's the idea. But we actually, how can I say, we put a weight on the part of which was ordinary, the ordinary variance, and the part which are actually the tree. So you can modulate, this is like a one-parameter family that goes from ordinary PCA all the way to DPCOA. So you can modulate, and you can actually get the data to tell you what the ideal parameter, you know, tuning parameter is. And this is called adaptive generalized PCA, and it's Julia Fukuyama who wrote, there's a program on GitHub that you can use, and yes?
Tell you with respect to what objective?
Sorry? Would it be a metric?
No, with what objective, when you say let the data tell you where to interpolate between those two?
You can look at the different criteria. You can do it by cross-validation, or you can do it with regards to some other information that you have. In this case, we actually have a change point, which we know. As I say, I'm not an objective statistician. I refuse to be dumb. So I know something about this data. I know when we gave the clean out to the subjects. So if we can find a change point which is coherent with our data, that's what I'm looking for. And this is the output. So here's the phylogenetic tree of the different taxa. These are coefficients which actually correspond to the taxa, and they appear on the branches. It's a little bit hard to see here. But here is how these different taxa jump up and down. And so here you can see that this RSV305 goes way down during the perturbation and then reestablishes itself perfectly. So it's very resilient taxa. So we have these profiles of these different taxa, and we could see, you know, that's what we're interested in. So that enables us to see that. So I can give you all the details in the paper. We have a Docker image and three bioconductor packages and a data set, which are all public, which go with the paper. So I encourage you to ask me questions, you know, offline or by email if you want to try this out. I do think it's really important to say that everybody could have come up with a different method. We could have done different types of models, and it's interesting to compare between methods. And so I'm open to other people analyzing the data and telling me, oh, you got that completely wrong, and so on. So we do try to make a reproducible research workflow. And you saw these RSVs, and in fact, what they are I've changed the names from OTUs. So in my field, we often call them OTUs. There's been a big mistake made in defining the units, the strains with which we work. And this was, you know, I took OTUs to be standard, and I didn't ask how this raw data was profiled at the beginning. And I realized that there had been a mistake. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what we did for this mistake. And this is about data 2. And so if you want to see exactly how you use all of this data too, we did make a complete workflow in F1000 Research, which has the code. So the strain level analysis, and this came up in the talk that Oleg gave this morning, that the we'd like to know more about certain strains, and I'll just motivate it and tell you why. We did two studies on pregnancy and predicting preterm, and the main thing that came out when we did these studies was that there are certain taxa which came out as really important. And the main one that came out was Gardnerella. And we were able to revisit the data, and actually we took a different class of subjects, a different ethnicity, different background, and we found the same result. But we also found that it wasn't all the strains of Gardnerella that were associated with preterm birth. So that was something that was important for us. And that's why it's sort of the attention to detail in this case is very important. So here, this Gardnerella straining, we were able to do it by ignoring what I said about distances. So distances, forget all the beginning of the talk. I said distances were really important. Distances aren't everything. And this is a mistake that we made doing OTUs. So it's much better to have strain information than not have strain information. Here, when you follow the different women, you can see that the strains stay about the same, but we don't have the strain resolution when you use the old method. So how do people build what are called OTUs? They use a distance. And so if you have strains which occur 100 times more than other strains, the OTU method takes a radius of a fixed distance, which doesn't take into account the frequency. And that's a bad kind of distance. You want a distance which tells you whether you have, and this is what annoys me when people, you know, compare women and men in math, you know, Larry Summers and so on. The thing is, if you don't have the same number of baseline people you're comparing to, of course, if you have 10,000 men, you know, you have much higher extreme points. If you have 100 women, you're going to have much less extreme points. So the frequency underlying is not independent. You know, the extreme points are not independent of the frequencies. And this is a mistake that everybody seems to make. And so this was a mistake that people made on OTUs. And we modeled the frequencies taking into account you know, that some of the OTUs are much, some of the strains are much more frequent, you're going to see many more errors if they're much more frequent. And if you take that into account, we have this error model, and we were able to, I'm going to go back to show you what this gave us. This comes from this new probabilistic error model in which we've incorporated the frequencies with which you see the strains. And we're able to denoise. If you have a strain which occurs 100,000 times, you're going to see with some Poisson error, you know, five errors away will be quite frequent within that. And if you have a sequence which is five away, it's probably just a noisy version of your very frequent sequence. So this method has completely changed how we're able to do the straining. And I wish we could do it for metagenomics. And if anybody is interested in doing a really hard project, it would be to take this that we've done for one gene and do it for a whole set of marker genes. And so that's a paper that appeared in Nature Methods with Ben Callahan. And I don't have time to tell you about the registration that we did to do uncertainty, but I'll just show you this picture. My goal has been that when we make these multidimensional dimension of plots with PCOA, we don't use ellipses. The data are never normal. You can't use ellipses, but you can do Bayesian computations which give you Bayesian confidence intervals. And here we have confidence regions around points by using Bayesian posteriors, and it's much better than just trying to say everything is normally distributed, which it's not. So I'm going to finish. Thank all the statisticians who make all their data available in Bioconductor because I use it a lot. We have a lot of different GitHub repos, and everything to do with PhiloSeq was developed by Joey, and he has very good tutorials. I work mostly with David Relman, and Elizabeth Purdom is the first person I worked with on the microbiome, and these are other people who do proteins, and that's my lab group, and I'm hiring a postdoc, and I know you can't come from statistics because there is no such thing, but if you come from physics, I'll take you. Ben Callahan, I think the physicists are the donor model for, you know, people who... Okay, that's enough. Thank you. That's good.